Our first guest on the program today is an investigative journalist, a Pulitzer Prize finalist, the author of several books, including The Pentagon's Brain, Area 51, and her newest, Phenomena, The Secret History of the U.S. Government's Investigations into Extrasensory Perception and Psychokinesis. Annie Jacobson joins us this afternoon. Annie, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
The book is absolutely wonderful. I couldn't put it down. A fascinating story that reads in many ways like fiction because so much of it seems so unbelievable.
I mean, it's a real battleground story. You've got science versus the supernatural and the federal government involved. So it's like huge points of contention at every turn.
And the origin story goes all the way back pretty much in a straight line to the Nazis, and in particular, Heinrich Himmler.
Yes. When you research war and weapons and the federal government, you find that almost all roads lead back to the Nazis.
Once the Nazis were out of the picture, as the Russians worked their way from one side and the Americans from the other, then we upped the ante a little bit more, and it became what you call a psychic arms race between those two nations.
Yes, I found these documents in the National Archives called Das Annenerbe, and those were Himmler's department that was looking into extrasensory perception, psychokinesis, map dowsing. And our intelligence agents got essentially half the cache of these secret documents, and the Soviets got the other half. And of course, that set off this battle, this psychic arms race, as it became known.
And that race was really to find a way to essentially weaponize the talents of these exceptional people.
Yes, and when you think about how far back in history, the idea of divination, the idea of like prophecy and knowing the unknown, you know, it's all rulers have been interested in this since civilization began, and our modern government is no different. And I was astonished to find out that it begins with the Nazis, you know, our finding the Nazi documents after the war. But what really surprised me that it's still going on today at the Defense Department.
What was fascinating for me in so many ways was that much of this story takes place right here in Maine at the little known about, little discussed around here, Roundtable Foundation near Camden that began back in the early 1950s.
I know, and I loved that part of the book, researching it and finding documents from none other than Marcella DuPont, her collection of letters at the Library of Congress. She was one of the benefactors of this research at the Roundtable Foundation in this kind of fabulous home on the ocean, and all of these, you know, very wealthy and the culturally elite, Aldous Huxley among them, the Forbes, the DuPonts, the Astors. They would get together with Andrea Puharik, who was kind of the first real scientist that the CIA had in this work, and they would kind of discuss these big ideas, you know, where does this come from, the sixth sense, if you will. Is it something internal? Is it physiological? Or is it supernatural? And they just spent hours up there in Maine discussing this in front of like a roaring fire, and it all sounded so glamorous. But of course, there were extraordinary consequences when you think about the CIA and the Defense Department getting involved.
We're talking with Annie Jacobson here on Downtown. Her new book is entitled Phenomena. The characters in your book are right out of fiction, right out of film noir in many ways. You mentioned Andrea Puharik, Ingo Swann, Clive Baxter, Uri Geller that we knew about from his appearances on TV back in the 70s, and so many remarkable stories about so many fascinating individuals.
I know, and I tracked down those who are still living, interviewed them, like Geller, interviewed him at his fabulous home in Israel and in England. I mean, you know, Geller made a fortune map dowsing, that kind of quasi supernatural occult talent, if you will, where you swing a pendulum over a map. And Geller has this ability to locate where the gold is, where the oil is, and he became incredibly wealthy, amassed this fortune by map dowsing for mining companies, you know, giant international mining companies around the world, working on commission.
I love the story as a big space geek as a kid, the story of Edgar Mitchell, who was on Apollo 14. I think he was the sixth man to walk on the moon. And this man of science who had gone to MIT, who dared to venture into what many thought was pseudoscience, and it changed his life, didn't it?
Oh, my God. He was one of my favorite people to interview. I think I did the last interviews with him before he passed. And, you know, he had what was called a conversion event, and it's a key concept in the book because many scientists who get into this work, the work of phenomena, have that moment where suddenly something happens to him where they can no longer see the world the way they did before with their rational scientific mind. They suddenly see it opens up, essentially their doorways of perception are open, and they see things differently, and then they pursue this science, which I have to say has a lot more gray area questions than it does, you know, black and white hard lines.
Annie, were you surprised at the correlation that you found between scientific skeptics and atheists?
I was. I absolutely was because, I mean, as a national security reporter, I don't really report on faith. But this came up in interviewing the scientific skeptics. They were very clear with me that they were atheists and were very kind of, you know, suggested that anyone, including me, who would even report on such issues as extrasensory perception was somehow intellectually inferior. And that stemmed, I found, from my interviews with them, from this idea that if you believe in God, if you're a person of faith, higher power, Buddha, any kind of conception there, those scientific skeptics say that is supernatural. And I thought that was really interesting. I hadn't realized that to them, God is this kind of supernatural being in the same category as the aliens.
I thought it was really interesting, too, that, well, the United States, both governments, really, the U.S. and the Soviet Union, to make the study of these people and these skills more palatable, simply change the names of things.
Exactly. And that is what they're doing today, which I find remarkable. At the DOD, the Office of Naval Research, has a program going on called Advanced Perceptual Competences. Well, that's just ESP dressed up in a fancy kind of name that falls under the rubric of, you know, high technology science. There's another one they call sense making. But one of the scientists currently at the Office of Naval Research did go on record saying what they were investigating was the spidey sense.
Well, it's so interesting to me, too, what happened in the mid to late 1970s. And a number of these people worked somewhere in the Defense Department. Some were civilians that were brought in who had these special skills. And the work that they did using, I guess, what we would call remote viewing. But I was particularly taken with the story of the gentleman who discovered the submarine program that we know of from the Hunt for Red October and was able to do this from a distance with incredible accuracy, even when our spy satellites didn't know what was going on.
It's an incredible story. I mean, it's called an intelligence first. And the fellow you're talking about was a guy named Joe McMonagle. He was called Remote Viewer 001, kind of like James Bond is 007. He was 001. And remote viewing, again, a kind of dressed up word for ESP, because God forbid the Defense Department or the CIA has anything to do with the supernatural. But McMonagle absolutely saw, in quotes, because how could he have seen it, that the Soviets were building this Typhoon-class submarine, which later became famous in the Hunt for Red October. He saw it first. Satellites couldn't see it. Human intelligence couldn't locate it. And he reported it to the Joint Chiefs of Staff. They belittled this idea. I mean, he described in detail this remarkable, monstrous submarine. He even got the code name of the submarine. Everyone belittled it. And then, lo and behold, a couple months later, the Typhoon appears in the harbor, and the Joint Chiefs of Staff have to admit that Joe McMonagle got what is called an intelligence first.
And the concern was not just that the Soviets were working on these projects, but they could find a way to weaponize this and perhaps to even control things, to move objects from a distance, and even in some cases, worries that people could be trained to stop the hearts of key people in the military.
That's right. The Soviets had this famous female psychokinetic person. Her name was Nina Kulangina. She was beautiful, and she also happened to have been a tank operator when she was 15 years old at the Battle of Leningrad. Her story is incredible, and she allegedly had this ability to stop the beating heart of a frog. She was filmed in a laboratory experiment in Leningrad doing this, and the civilian scientist at the Pentagon, a guy by the name of Dale Graff, who I interviewed at length for the book, was in charge of trying to determine whether or not this talent Nina Kulangina had was some kind of black propaganda or it was real. Because you're right, if it was real, my God. And again, the declassified Pentagon documents show this, that they were saying, oh my God, someone like her could stand next to a congressman or a general or even the president of the United States.
We're talking with Annie Jacobson here on Downtown. Her amazing new book is entitled Phenomena. Can you explain in simple terms that we can all understand the concept of quantum entanglement?
Well, Einstein called it spooky action at a distance. And, you know, it's this idea that no matter how far apart two atoms may be, they can affect one another. And physicists, modern physicists, are now looking at this as a possible explanation of faster-than-light knowledge, because that's what this would have to be if you're able to get knowledge from one place to the other telepathically. But again, these experiments that are being able to be done with quantum entanglement, it was hypothesis back in the day of Einstein. Now, scientists around the world are conducting experiments that actually demonstrate this as a reality. So those who are in the work of the phenomena are looking to seeing quantum entanglement as a possible explanation for mental telepathy.
You did so much deep background work on this. You had to rely a lot on Freedom of Information Act requests. How reluctant was the government to share information about these programs?
You know, it's amazing being a reporter how you just kind of get a lucky get. And one day when I was really thinking about pursuing this idea, and I file Freedom of Information Act requests all the time, I came home and there on my fence post at my house was a big, thick manila envelope, and the return address was Central Intelligence Agency. And it was them granting 1,000 pages of documents on the phenomena as part of a FOIA request. So luck always comes into play. Or as Pasteur would say, fortune favors the prepared mind, because boy, do I file a lot of FOIA requests.
So the conclusion of the government was that these powers, these skills are real, but they're hard to count as scientific because they're not reliable and they're not often repeatable and they're certainly unpredictable.
Absolutely, and that's the big point that the scientific skeptics take, rightly so, that the phenomena do not pass scientific method muster. They don't pass the five steps, the most important being they're not repeatable. And if they're not repeatable, then they're just a hypothesis. And so you have this conundrum that CIA and Defense Department have faced for 70 years and continue to face now, which is that it exists as a real phenomena in the laboratory. They have seen it, and yet they can't repeat it consistently. So that just leads the door open to more research, which perhaps leads us to the idea, or rather the question, will modern technology be able to solve this age-old mystery? Is it science? Is it fantasy? Is it fact? Is it the supernatural? I mean, I just hope I'm around long enough to find out the answer.
And where do you think the research is going now? What's the next step in the evolution of our understanding of these processes?
It's a little bit of a reboot of what it was in the 70s. Joe McMonagle that you talked about, the guy who saw the typhoons, he was singled out by the Pentagon because he had an uncanny ability to preempt or pre-see Viet Cong ambush when he was a soldier in Vietnam. And that's why they recruited him into the program, because he had this precognitive, prophetic, if you will, ability. Well, the new program at the Office of Naval Research is born of a similar situation in Iraq, where a soldier was on patrol in Mosul with a group of soldiers and said, do not go down that street. He had a prophecy or premonition, if you will, that there was an IED there. They sent a robot in. There was an IED there. Now that soldier becomes interesting to the Defense Department. The difference between the two situations is today the Defense Department is having the soldier of today looked at by neurobiologists, computer technologists. They're modeling his brain, mapping it in, and as one defense scientist said to me, looking at ways, if they can model what this physiology is, then they can accelerate it and, of course, weaponize it.
It is a remarkable book and a truly fascinating read. Annie, thank you so much for your work, and thank you so much for being with us this afternoon to talk about phenomena.
Thank you for having me.